This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If you think about how much the farmer gets when the consumer spends money, for every dollar, the farmer gets about 7 cents on the dollar. And that number has been shrinking and shrinking over the years.
In the words of Robert Bork, the controversial legal scholar and one of the fathers of modern antitrust law who died this past December 19th at age 85, courts that know better ought not to make rules unrelated to reality. Well, the reality that Professor Bork and his fellow originalists strived for has manifested itself in a monopolistic food system that keeps prices low and our waistlines bulging. This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, food writer Tom Laskaway, tells us why he believes that Bork's ideas of linking economics to antitrust helped give us cheap meat and dairy, as well as massive quantities of processed food, and why that's a problem. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Tom Laskaway. He's the founder and executive director of the Food and Environment Reporting Network. He's also a contributing writer at Grist, who covers food and agricultural policy. Tom, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks very much, Alex. Great to be here.
You've written some fascinating pieces over the last couple of years for Grist, talking about how we've gotten to where we are in terms of our food and agricultural industry and the consolidation in the industry. Robert Bork just passed, one of the more controversial figures, not only because of his not getting confirmed by the Senate to the Supreme Court in the early 80s, he also was a real instrumental figure in creating what we have today in terms of our modern food and agricultural system. Give us a background on how Robert Bork influenced what we eat and what we put on the table today and how we pay for it.
Sure, absolutely. It's funny, of course, to think that Robert Bork had anything to do with this. I mean, as you said, his main legacy for most people is his failure to become a Supreme Court justice. And I think that it was not really even something that too many legal scholars or pundits were even aware of. This is his involvement in this other aspect of law, which is to say, antitrust law. And so it just seemed to me that out of the blue, we suddenly have this guy who turns out to be somewhat of an architect of the food sector, even if it was in an indirect way. It comes down to this idea that big business is not inherently bad. In a lot of ways, that was really what he gave the legal field. But before his work, which really started in the 60s and really kind of came to prominence in the 70s, big business was just considered a bad thing. That's what antitrust law was all about. It was preventing businesses from becoming big. Didn't matter why, didn't matter what they were doing. If they were big, they were perceived to be acting against the interests of small businesses. That was it. That there was actually a legal term, and it was inhospitality. Big business is inhospitable to small business, end of story. And Robert Bork was very concerned that what was happening with that concept is you were simply protecting inefficient businesses. And now the almost, now we can say it's almost a joke aspect of his work. He was really concerned about communism. It was the middle of the Cold War, obviously, in the 60s. And his feeling was antitrust law was killing the American spirit because it would allow inefficient businesses to triumph over the entrepreneurs and innovators. So he almost single-handedly invented the term consumer welfare. And he managed to convince a lot of people, a lot of lawyers, and in fact the Supreme Court in the 70s, that consumer welfare was a central concept of antitrust law, that it was actually inherent in the congressman who wrote the original antitrust law, the Sherman antitrust law.
In 1890. And
exactly.
And this is what all antitrust law is based on. And when I was reading your article in Grist, it's excellent, and I should recommend our listeners check it out at grist.org. One of the basic tenets that seemed to influence Professor Bork was that monopolies are okay as long as the prices are low. And I remember in the Sherman antitrust law that basically it was to prohibit abusive monopolies. So under his strict reading of it, if the prices are low, they're not abusive. Is that, and it seems almost like a Federalist kind of mentality, the way this strict constitutional interpretation of the Scalias and the Thomases are today on the Supreme Court. Would that be an apt analogy?
Well, I mean, the way I would think of it is that he reoriented antitrust law away from business versus business. So away from big business versus small business, and reoriented it on the consumer. How is the what's the consumer getting out of this merger? If the consumer is actually getting something out of the merger, typically it would be in this form of low prices, then you should look favorably on the merger. Because he brought up this idea of consumer welfare and the possibility of increased efficiency, suddenly there was this whole set of analytical tools that they would use to figure out, well, what's going to happen after these companies merge. And by and large, you would see prices drop. Now, you mean, think about in the old days, original monopoly concerns were things like the railroads. And, you know, railroads would consolidate and get larger and larger, and they would sort of jack up prices for freight and so on. And that was the harm that was being produced by these monopolies. But what has been happening certainly over the last few decades, and what Bork understood probably would happen, was that these monopolies or these corporations who would be consolidating by buying up competitors, in fact, would end up lowering prices. And there's no question that that's what we've seen in every sector, especially in the food sector. You see these meatpacking companies expanding, so that there are really just a handful of meatpacking companies that handle all the processing of meat in this country. And it's true in chicken, pork, and beef. You see it in milk. You see a huge control of the milk supply. So you see it across the board, you know, and you see it in retail as well. You see Walmart, which has a huge impact. One out of every $4 Americans spend on groceries goes to Walmart. And in some cities, Walmart controls 50% of grocery sales. So it's almost universal in the food system.
Let's backtrack a little bit. It wasn't always this way, obviously. Why don't you talk about how this system came about and give us kind of a timeline, if you will.
The food system was actually fairly stable all the way through the post-war period until the 60s and 70s. I mean, that's what's sort of interesting. I think one thing that's very important to note is that Bork supplied a legal theory that supported this idea of consumer welfare, but he also looked at the relationships between companies. So in other words, the supply chain of these companies, and decided that onerous relationships between companies. So thinking of like the rancher who has to sell his cattle to the processor, and then the processor who sells it up and down the chain, those relationships in the old days would get a lot of scrutiny. They were considered to be an area for anti-competitive practices. What Bork said is that actually those aren't really a concern, especially in the face of a benefit to consumer welfare.
So what was his reading of consumer welfare? Was it wasn't Ralph Nader by any means, was it?
No, it was essentially low prices. That was the test. The test was we knew a market was working because prices were low.
He may not have been able to see this far in advance when he set forth these consumer welfare theories in the 60s, but now we have a real obesity problem in this country, and we also have a major issue with climate change, and they're connected. And the food prices are connected to that as well. Why don't you and connect the dots if you can?
Prices at the supermarket, by and large, are lower than they've ever been for meat, for packaged foods, especially for some vegetables, but but if there's an area where there's been inflation, well, it's in fruits and vegetables. And we spend less than just about anyone else in the developed world, Americans do, on our food. We spend about 9% of our income on food, which is much less than anybody else. And a lot of people consider that a victory of the American dream, that we have abundant food that's inexpensive. So, then we have to look at, well, what is that food? What is it that people are buying? And of course, Americans do buy a lot of processed and packaged foods. These foods do tend to be high in salt, sugar, and fat. And we, of course, want people to eat a healthy, balanced diet that tends to be, that needs to be focused on fresh foods. Already, we know that fresh foods, like fruits and vegetables, tend to be more expensive and experienced more inflation than these other foods, processed foods, where you do have a small group of companies dominating, meat and dairy, where you also have a small set of companies dominating. And if we then think about the effect that climate change will have on the world, well, you're going to see, as we already are, droughts, wildfires, general climate instability, storms, all these things are going to affect agriculture. And then we are going to come to rely on food companies to provide us with calories the most efficient way possible, which heavily processed foods. So we're going to eat more and more of these foods that are not good for us and that are often high in fat, salt, and sugar, which contribute to obesity. And we're going to eat less of the healthier foods because they're going to become more expensive as the climate and agricultural areas worsens. And we're now going to see an obesity epidemic accelerate.
One night, Farmer Brown was taking the air. Locked up the barnyard with greatest of care. Down in the hen house, something stirred. When he hollered, "Who there?" This is word he heard. Ain't nobody here but us chicken. It ain't nobody here at all. So calm yourself and stop that fuss. It ain't nobody here but us. We chickens trying to sleep and you bust in and hobba, 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 hobba with your chin. Ain't nobody here but us chicken. Ain't nobody here at all. And drop your fuss, stomping around. It ain't nobody here but us. We chickens trying to sleep and you bust in and hobba, 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 hobba. It's a sin. Tomorrow is a busy day. We got things to do. We got eggs to lay.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to food writer Tom Laskaway. So the theory of low prices being the key to consumer welfare is counterintuitive, right? There is a study that you write about by epidemiologist Adam Dranowski from the University of Washington. Why don't you give us a background on those findings?
Right. Well, he looked at how and where people shop. And he was originally inspired to look at to what extent the concept of the food desert is real. The food desert is, of course, this idea that there are areas where people don't have convenient access to food of any kind, much less healthy food, and they don't have supermarkets, and so they eat poorly. This is the theory. So when he actually looked at it, what he realized is actually people don't shop entirely based on proximity. So people will go outside of their neighborhood or their area to shop for food because they're looking for low prices. So okay, he has kind of established that low prices are the prime motivator for people, especially coming farther down the income chain. And then he looked at what was sold at these low-price supermarkets compared to what was sold at the more expensive supermarkets. You know, think of like a Whole Foods. And he found that both in terms of what was sold and what people bought at the two different kinds of supermarkets was very different. People who shop for price tended to buy more on healthy food. People who shop for low price tended to buy more on healthy food. And people who shopped at the higher price supermarkets tended to eat more healthily and had lower rates of obesity. So you already see kind of what the effect of shopping based on price does. And as people feel more and more pressure to do that, and as the healthy food gets more expensive and the processed food stays more competitive because companies are able to take advantage of all sorts of production efficiencies and technology to produce food, processed food more cheaply, you're going to see that continued divergence, that upper income people are going to be able to still eat well, and the lower down you go, the income levels, you're going to see obesity much more of a challenge.
And it seems like the people who are worried about making sure that prices are low were really thinking about hunger as the real issue. But the real issue in obesity and what we're facing now is not hunger as much as food insecurity. Can you define that for us?
Sure. I mean, food insecurity is, it's actually a real thing. It's something the government tracks and studies, and it's defined as limited or uncertain access to adequate food. About 15% of American households reported food insecurity at some point in 2011. It's the last time we have data. It's not the same as hunger because you're probably getting enough calories. It's really more of a psychological state. And so you end up perhaps making poor decisions about what you're going to eat and how much you're going to eat. And they've done some studies where it's shown that people who experience food insecurity actually feed, especially their children, less healthy food. And so suddenly, if we're just thinking about price versus calories, you know, as in getting people enough calories to get through the day, we're not getting the full picture because it turns out the quality of those calories matter a lot. And, you know, this goes back to the consumer welfare concept, which is it was entirely based on price because, gee, it's economics. It's kind of hard to measure welfare and happiness and quality of life and all these things. So we'll just focus on price because if people can afford food, they're getting enough food. But of course, that was done at a time when, you know, a lot of these processed foods didn't even exist. People's diet, you know, 30, 40 years ago was in fact quite different. People drank hardly, I mean, compared to what we do now, people drank hardly any soda. It's hard to believe that the explosion in soda consumption is really a product of the time, you know, after 1980, but that's the case.
And we could go through the consolidation statistics, which are pretty breathtaking. And let me just quote from your article, the 2007 study from University of Missouri, that the four largest companies controlled 82% of the beef packing industry, 85% of soybean processing, 63% of pork packing, and on and on. So this consolidation has a real effect in crafting policy and thwarting policy. Why don't you talk about some of the efforts to reform the system that have been set forth and why we haven't seen any real change over the last 4 to 6 years.
When Obama was elected, one of his early acts was to name a very aggressive head of the antitrust division, Christine Varney. And she got together with the USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack to organize a set of workshops on agricultural consolidation. And they were going to look at this problem and they were going to see what was real and what was hype about this issue. And they did a whole series of hearings. And farmers who don't like to talk, certainly don't like to talk to the government if they can avoid it, came forward and told these horror stories about working with Monsanto in large parts of farm country. Monsanto, the only seed that you can buy is Monsanto's genetically modified seed. Working with the buyers of their crops, whether it's grains, whether it's fruits and vegetables, and certainly hearing from ranchers about the problems with the meat packers and the buyers of beef, pork, and chicken. There was a lot of hope that that would transform federal policy. But of course, what happens fairly soon after these hearings, which take place in 2009, is the 2010 midterms. And the Republicans take over the House, very militant group of Tea Party Republicans, and they start attacking all of this work that the administration is doing, which they consider essentially anti-corporate, and the administration backs down. And what Varney and her team realized as they dug into this and got all the information and saw what was going on, they realized that it would require Congress to make any changes to the agricultural sector, because thanks to Bork's theories of consumer welfare and allowing these kind of supply chain agreements, this vertical integration, there really wasn't anything illegal going on, not by federal law, by current federal law. They would lose in the courts if they tried to stop it. And so they would need Congress to sort of turn around and change the Sherman Antitrust Act, say some of these things that were going on in the agricultural sector weren't okay, and they wouldn't. And there was a parallel process that was also going on that came out of the 2008 Farm Bill, which is that gargantuan piece of legislation that sets most of federal agricultural policy, that required the administration to update and enforce this longstanding law known by its acronym GPSA, that controlled the meat industry, which basically had never really been enforced. Meat industry was pretty much allowed to do what it wanted in terms of contracts with ranchers and so on.
So GPSA, it had existed for quite some time, but then they were trying to give it a little more teeth. Is that correct?
I mean, in essence, yes. GPSA existed and had essentially never been honestly enforced ever.
And GPSA stands for the Grain Inspection Packers and Stockyard Administration, for those scoring at home.
Indeed. So the USDA went through and came up with a set of rules that would enforce the law and change the landscape of how the meat packers and processors operated. And the industry and House Republicans freaked out. And the White House then freaked out. This is all happening in 2010, 2011. And they basically threw the law, threw these new rules out. So there have been some rules published, some changes made, very minor, some changes in how the chicken industry is going to be able to operate in terms of the terms of their contracts and so on. So it goes, brings us back to Bork, who incorporated some of the ideas that were going on in economics in the 60s, especially being worked on in the University of Chicago, what became known as the Chicago School, which basically said the free market is always right.
Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing. That's all that Bobby left me. Yeah. Feeling good was easy, Lord. Bobby sang the blues. I said, feeling good was good enough for me. Mm-hmm. It's good enough for me and my Bobby McGee. La da da, la da la da. La da 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 da.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to food writer Tom Laskaway. Tom, one of the messaging that the industry, the meatpacking industry, or any of the big ag players can set forth is this is going to hit consumers in their wallets. It's going to cost money. We saw that here in California with the GMO labeling Proposition 37 that got shot down. It was a very similar campaign saying this is going to cost you more money because of unnecessary red tape. And there was a study you quote by the meatpacking industry commissioned a study that said that the reforms that on GPSA would cost $14 billion. They can just send out these insane numbers to say, this is going to cost us all a lot of money and cost us jobs, and that's the fear-mongering involved in it. But the status quo is obviously untenable as well. What needs to give? Do we really need Congress to act in order to do that, or is that kind of a cop-out from the Obama administration?
This question of what would happen, what's the effect on prices from all of this? There's no question that there could be some effect, but it's usually pennies on the pound. If you think about how much the farmer gets when the consumer spends money, for every dollar, the farmer gets about 7 cents on the dollar. And that number has been shrinking and shrinking over the years. So where's the rest of that 93 cents going? Well, it's going to processors and packers and distributors and retailers. So when you hear about the effect that things are going to have on the bottom line, on food prices, keep in mind that all this huge amount of money has been taken out of the hide of farmers already. And there's a huge amount of profit in it for what are effectively middlemen. And it's not at all clear that much of those costs from any changes that you see would be passed directly on to the consumer. There's actually a lot of slack in that and a lot of people making a lot of profit. So the price question, and it's very tricky to figure out exactly what effect these would have on prices. Most of the changes that they're talking about would have a minimal effect. You know, one issue that you probably hear about is the use of antibiotics in agriculture.
Sure.
A lot of the research that's been done suggests that getting rid of the overuse or ending the overuse of antibiotics in agriculture would cost consumers perhaps 5 cents per pound for meat, which is probably, for the vast majority of people, not something that they would see, that they would feel at all.
Especially when you consider how much meat we eat compared to the rest of the world.
We eat less and less red meat. I mean, we eat a lot of chicken. And we certainly eat similar amounts of meat to a lot of the industrialized countries. And really what the issue is that a lot of the developing world wants to eat as much meat as we do. And that's where you get to have a problem, because how do you produce that amount of meat for that many people? But anyway, the price issue is always thrown out there. And of course, there's nothing a politician, you know, fears more than rising food prices. So politicians are very responsive to that argument from producers. But it's not necessarily the crux of the issue. For consumers and how they can respond to this, I think the answer is you think about where you're buying your food and what you're eating. I mean, not everyone can shop at Whole Foods, but certainly buying in season at a farmer's market is competitive with a supermarket. That's actually been established by research. And if you're willing to do that, you can know that the money that you're spending is going directly to the farmer. You're cutting out just about all the middlemen, and you can be satisfied about that. But obviously that's not a solution for everyone, and it's not a solution all year round. The fact is we do need changes to the legal framework to allow companies to allow smaller businesses to remain competitive with big businesses. And it's not at all clear there's a lot of appetite for that, because it's not just going to affect food businesses if they do that. It's going to affect Walmart. It's going to affect Amazon. It's going to affect the wireless companies. So there are a lot of companies that are very interested in kind of keeping the antitrust landscape the same. And it makes it a big challenge for the food business.
You can read his work at Grist and also at the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Tom Laskaway, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by James Brown, Clarence Gatemouth Brown, and Janice Joplin.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.